You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Hey, Power Athlete Nation. Staying on the vein of human performance and really focusing on the brain and neuroscience, we have Dr. David Petrino on the podcast. He's the official medical provider for Red Bull-sponsored athletes in North America. He's also a physical therapist with a PhD in neuroscience. He worked as a clinician in Australia before moving to the U.S. to study computational neuroscience at Harvard, MIT, and NYU. He's currently the doctor of rehab innovation at Mount Sinai Health Systems and a professor of rehabilitation and human performance at the Ithacan School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. He also heads up the Petrino Lab, which is a group of scientists, engineers, and clinicians with one singular goal, using technology to help people perform better. And we get into just about everything on this podcast in terms of neuroscience, health and performance, wearables, and all those key things that you're looking to learn. I also have an interesting connection here in that we were both approached to work with the Drake's Fury crew that's trying to row from Antarctica to Chile. And we're helping to develop systems to get these guys fitter and be able to survive the task of rowing 645 miles over the most treacherous waters on the planet. So if you're into human performance, as I know you are, buckle in for Dr. David Petrino. Doc, what's happening?
Hey, how's it going?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Doing well.
Did you get home okay after we hung out last?
Yep. Easy trip and looking forward to the next one.
Nice. Well, for those of you guys that don't know, I met Dr. David Petrino recently when we were doing the Drake's Passage crew. So we both got pulled in, I guess, within this task where a couple high-performing former Navy SEALs and SF guys are going to try to row from, I don't know if it's Antarctica to Chile or Chile to Antarctica. All I know, it's 645 miles, 650 miles in a rowboat with six guys, three row at a time. And the last guys that did it took 12 days. But I think two of those days they had to batten down the hatches and get thrown around in 40-foot swells. So these guys came in to kind of, for us to put them through a strength conditioning diagnostic and really just check the level of readiness as we start this training block. And they brought Dr. David in to come in and test all the metrics that we had from VO2 max and lactate. So I'd love to discuss a little bit about that and then also get into the Petrino lab.
Yeah, absolutely. Antarctica to Chile is the direction they're going. And kind of crazy when you say it out loud.
Did why Antarctica to Chile and not Chile to Antarctica? I didn't necessarily get that question answered yet.
Yeah, me either, but I trust them.
Yeah. Well, the just as you saw in the shop, I'm into fabricating and trucks and like the mechanical aspect. So I'm super fascinated by, you know, what the boat looks like and how, and I guess there's like one boat maker somewhere in Denmark, Sweden, somewhere up, you know, in that part of the world that actually builds these open water rowboats, which, I mean, it's got to be the most niche market I've ever heard of.
Yeah. Not since the Viking days, I guess. So pretty incredible all around.
Yeah. So let's get into a little bit. So the guys came in. I mean, obviously we checked out their vitals, had Doc Parsley work with them, but I'm real fascinated on the VO2 max and the lactate and what you were hoping to collect, you know, doing your testing. And more importantly, how can we use that testing to improve the performance and more importantly, the durability? Because the issue that I'm wrestling with in the training isn't necessarily, you know, are they the fittest or they best, but can they survive for 12 days rowing 90 minutes on, 90 minutes off. You know, there's not anywhere on the boat that's technically big enough for them to stretch out and lay. So now we're looking at like sleep cycles. We're looking at energy expenditure. They have to bring enough food to be able to survive and be able to manage all these other things.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that was the perspective that we started with when we were talking about precisely what we would do with understanding metabolic demands. We were so lucky to have Dr. Jamie Wood, who is our metabolics guru, come out and do the testing on the gents. And that's going to be one of many testing sessions. You know, what we're going to do is get more and more task specific because we're fortunate enough to have this portable VO2 max testing system. And what we're trying to understand initially is what are the metabolic demands? So what are these guys looking like at rest? What are they looking like when they're working at 10%, 50%, 100%? And what are they looking like when they're completely exhausted and still having to push? Because as with most ultra endurance events, it's not going to be about who can pull the hardest. It's not going to be about, you know, who can go the fastest. It's only going to be about how are you managing your metabolic demands day to day and pushing through to the next day. So we need to, especially in unassisted attempts at a record like this, you need to really neatly understand, okay, well, if these are your metabolic demands, then these are your nutritional demands. And we're going to bring in an amazing nutritionist, Adina Neglia, to really, you know, build that out calorie to calorie so that they don't need to have 20 extra pounds or 30 extra pounds of food on board if they don't need it. So really with the VO2 max, that was one of the things that we were really trying to understand. And then also, you know, because we're Mount Sinai and we're a hospital system, we're also managing the sports medicine component. So we wanted to do a lot of baselining just to understand from a cognitive and a physical standpoint, where these gents are, so that if one of them, you know, God forbid, should take a hit to the head or get a shoulder injury or, you know, get a leg injury while they're out there, we know what their baseline was and we can rehabilitate them back to that baseline.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they really brought us on Evolved, to be able to come in and put a baseline together, make sure that they're strong, stable, they can, you know, move and effectively survive the demands that are placed in front of them. Unfortunately, we don't really know what the demands are. I mean, I know we have, you know, we pontificated, we thought a lot about it, we've talked about it, but, you know, you're mixing in, you know, the elements, obviously the seas, the craft, you know, obviously they're going to need some time in the craft to develop a sport-specific application, really just you know, in the boat time. But then you're thinking metabolic demands with calories, stress, lack of sleep. You know, they might hit big waves and bounce around like a cork for a day or two. Now you're looking at like potential seasickness and some other issues managing water. So I mean, as the list, and we started creating that list, it like started to become more and more daunting. And then do they have the mental fortitude to be able to go do something? And I've always believed that it's easier to do something that you've done before, or more importantly, attain something. Like if, you know, I've climbed Mount Everest, now all of a sudden climbing K2 doesn't seem nearly as impossible, whereas probably that first ascent becomes very impossible. So I talked to Judd and then also to Mike Sorelli, like, are there some warm-ups that these guys can do? Is there a shorter, you know, sprint that they can do where they get out in the boat, they work as a team, they kind of understand it? Because my biggest fear was like showing up in Antarctica with this boat and being like, okay, you guys been training on C2s and taking ice baths. Here's your gear. Like I was always a big believer in that you fight like you train. So I never wore anything on game day in the NFL that I didn't already wear in practice, down to cleats or whatever. So I was always like to have vetted all of my equipment and everything ahead of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's so important, especially when you're attempting something that very, very few people have ever done before and not knowing what to expect. Just trying to create some level of frame of reference becomes super important. I mean, even if it's something like, you know, Diana Nyad, who swam from Florida to Cuba unassisted, you know, she had a single song that she played in her head over and over again, and she knew that it was something intense, like 365 or 369 replays of this song. And all she had to do was replay that song 369 times and she would be in Cuba. But she knew the task. And so she had this understanding of, well, this is what I'm going to do. You know, when all else fails, I think that there is some value in being able to do something like that. But I also think that in an open ocean race like this, it's just so challenging because anything could happen. You may need to batten down the hatches for 2 days because a storm hits. So being able to cope with that level of uncertainty while stay on task, this is going to be a big challenge. Thankfully, in many ways, I think that the military background that these guys have is going to be, you know, there is no better preparation for that level of uncertainty. And these fellows know how to embrace the suck and they know how to, you know, adapt and overcome. But, you know, it's, there's a lot going on.
So why is it that the VO2 max is kind of the initial starting place? Like, why is that the hallmark? Like, that was the first thing. I mean, I wanted to check trunk stability, you know, to see how stable they are, go through an injury profile. You guys started with VO2 max, correct?
Yes, we actually started with resting metabolic rate.
Yes, yes.
Moved into VO2 max and then also did some work on understanding lactate threshold for these guys.
So why, I mean, obviously we need to know what the resting metabolic rate is just so that we can, you know, basically figure some, you know, BMR and basically what their calorie burns are and that. So, I mean, just in a basic health deal. But like, why has the VO2 max become really the gold standard for these individuals?
You know, honestly, I wouldn't say that it's necessarily the gold standard for sure. You know, right now what we're doing is with both the resting metabolic, the VO2 max, and also the lactate threshold, we're just trying to get a working understanding of how each of the athletes is burning energy. You know, that's where we're starting. And like I said, we want to get as task specific as humanly possible, because, you know, I think that one of the things that we can do to really prep these guys from a nutrition standpoint and an energy conservation standpoint, which is going to be the name of the game here, is really understand what their general energy conservation, their general energy expenditure looks like when they're working as hard as they possibly can, somewhere in between, and when they're purely resting. So this was really, you know, from our point of view, we were really starting from a standpoint of, let's just work on the basics. Let's just try and understand what each person's body is doing. And we're going to go deeper and deeper with each camp that we have with the guys to better understand what's going on, because this is just, you know, there's no way around it. This is going to be a complex ask, and we want to try and look at things from every single angle.
So with VO2 max, you know, I mean, obviously it can be trained to some degree, but like, what is like a, you know, I mean, if some, like, as I was pulling a bunch of research on VO2 max, it almost looked like genetically, maybe what you do as a young athlete sets a bunch of metabolic pathways and you kind of develop a VO2 max. And then after, let's say they were to test you at 20, there's a certain amount of capacity that you can attain up into the age of 30. And then they were talking about after like the age of 35, it was very difficult to increase your VO2 max outside of maybe 1 or 2%. I'm kind of just a little fascinated by that. Like how, you know, I mean, is it something where, you know, if you have a massive VO2 max, like I think they, when I looked it up, like the largest VO2 max in history was maybe it was a cross country skier, like from Norway, and all of his family were cross country Olympic skiers. And they had, you know, through the generations just been known to have greater capacity than everybody else. They could just go farther and go longer.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's 100% correct. I think that what you just said is a really good description of the literature out there, which is that there are things that you can put on the path to give you better VO2 max earlier in life, and then once you hit 35 or so, things tend to be pretty stable. I would say probably the most profound. And genetics does play a big role. I would say probably one of the most profound things you can do once you've worked on capacity as much as you can, just, you know, how much you can get into your lungs and how elastic your lungs are and how much work that you're doing to, you know, expand lungs and do breathing exercises and chest expansion and so on and so forth, which is why we're bringing in folks like Josh Dunst to work on breath work, is training at altitude. Because again, it just makes your body more efficient at utilizing the oxygen that you're taking in. So, you know, as well as taking in more oxygen, you're becoming more efficient with the oxygen that you're taking in. But to a large extent, you know, where you're at is where you're at for a lot of folks with VO2 max. And for us, that was the motivation, is just understanding what the baseline is, with the knowledge that it's not going to change around all that much. It's probably going to stay where it is. From our perspective, you know, the biggest VO2 maxes I've ever seen personally were, Tour de France races. They were just beyond anything I've seen before. Even in folks that I thought objectively were, well, subjectively I felt were probably more physically fit than the racers at the time that we took their VO2 maxes, they still had these enormous VO2 maxes. It's a fascinating measure for sure.
What's so fascinating, especially when you look at like the Tour de France guys, obviously there was a big drug, culture with the Tour de France, but you can't make chicken salad out of chicken shit. Like, those guys probably already had the capacity and were already outliers to be able to go do and compete. And, when you take an entire field of individuals that are, in some way performance enhancing, it's kind of evening the field. So people love to just discredit them. And I'm like, dude, Lance Armstrong was like a set of legs with a massive set of lungs. I mean, I know his VO2 max, they mentioned him not necessarily directly in the literature, but they referenced him in some other places as having one of like the largest recorded VO2 maxes. Side note, I was laughing a little bit when you were talking about the hypoxic chamber or like training at high altitude. My first year in Kansas City, we played in the season opener in Denver, and obviously, Mile High Stadium, and I gassed. Like, by halftime, I was done. Like, I didn't know if I needed an asthma inhaler, and I don't have asthma. Like, I just couldn't catch my lungs, and I was pretty upset about it. So I called a doctor buddy of mine, Tom Inkledon, who's got a lab down in Scottsdale, Arizona, called Cosenta. And I was like, Tom, like, what can I do to not gas? And he ended up sending me in the mail a hypoxic machine and a huge tent. And I pretty much had to build my bed in the tent and then pumped it in. And then I kind of did this like acclimation and basically slept at Everest Base Camp for like the next 2 years. And so it was in my bed and I slept at Everest Base Camp. And then all of a sudden, when we went to go play a Mile High, I never gassed anymore. And we had done a bunch of blood testing just to kind of see the results. And he's like, dude, your red blood cell count and everything is off the charts. And, there was the idea that, live at altitude, train low, so you can train with greater intensity. In hindsight, what I should have done is I probably should have like got a smaller bed and then put like a, echo bike or an assault and just done like a bunch of zone one, zone two cardio in there just to see if I could effectively blow it up. But that ended up being a pretty good little trick. So I never gassed again.
Yeah, it's amazing what altitude can do for you. With Red Bull, we did a project called Project Endurance. Each year, we hit a different element of endurance, and Project Endurance 3.0 was all about altitude. And we basically took a bunch of ultra endurance cyclists, and we ran a bunch of performance testing at sea level. So we're in Death Valley. And then same day we'd fly them up to the top of Mammoth Mountain and, so 7,000 feet and then do the same performance testing and they would just crash, and what was capable at sea level was certainly not capable. What was not possible, at altitude, except in the Alpine, cyclists. So a lot of ultra endurance cyclists are used to flat, and flat usually happens closer to sea level, whereas the folks that had done a couple of tours or were more experienced with altitude, they were able to maintain that performance. So that training paradigm really does make a big difference.
Yeah, no, I grew up in Southern California, and my parents bought a place in Mammoth in like the early 70s for like $15,000. So we still own it. And so we would drive up there and go skiing. Like, I mean, if we got 10, 15 weekends a year, that was pretty amazing. And then we'd go up there and fish and whatever. But we would always, at different parts of the year, take a drive through Death Valley. And I think there's parts of Death Valley that are actually below sea level. And you kind of go through it, and it's like you get out there in the middle of nowhere, and you were like, I know why it's called Death Valley, because this is by far the most desolate place on earth. It's what I always imagined Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, or I'm sorry, the original Mad Max when he's out there on, you know, in Australia. That's what it just kind of reminded me of. And then being able to go to Mammoth, which, I mean, if you fall on anything, like they got so much snow this year. It was probably the greatest snowpack ever. I mean, my brother sent me pictures where, like, you know, first floor condos completely buried. It's pretty amazing. So obviously the trainability, so they're, and I hate the word hack, because I usually think that people that use the word hack are hacks themselves, but is there like, you know, and I know we're going to test some protocols. Is there a real world protocol that if your VO2 max, you know, and the guys that are engaging in this Drake's Passage are over age of 35. So, I mean, you know, we're going to try to see if we can push the capacity, but things like you said, training at altitude and some of these other, you know, I don't want to call them hacks, just training modalities. What does that look like in terms of the implementation?
Yeah. I mean, I think, and this is why we've connected, Jard up with, Josh Dunst, is that first things first, breath work. I think this is a really simple volume problem, right? A lot of the time, if we're not doing proper chest expansion exercises, if we're not doing proper breath work, the bases of our lungs crumple down. And, you know, like a seated posture is like the absolute worst for this. The more time you spend sitting, and hunched, the more opportunity that the basal areas, the bottom areas of your lungs, are going to sort of crumple up and become harder to open. So starting off by getting people involved in intensive breathwork programs that really focus on chest expansion, really focus on increasing the functional volume of the lungs, that's the no-brainer. That's the stuff that we should be getting them doing yesterday to potentially improve their VO2 max. Because again, these guys know how to work hard. There's no question there. So then if we give them more functional volume, they're probably going to be able to do more with it. So, you know, so that's where we want to, that's where we want to start. And then from there, it's just, you know, the extent to which we can get them over and over practicing with that new range and with that new lung capacity, that's where we want to see if we can make some gains. And so Josh, you know, and his team, they're really great. You know, they've got people who are like free divers and things of that nature are working with them. And again, I wouldn't call these hacks. I would call these very targeted training. You work with a free diving coach, they can take you from a 2-minute breath hold to a 6-minute breath hold in a matter of weeks, because they know the mechanisms and they know the dynamics. And so that's, I think that is probably the best path to improving VO2 max in these fellas.
Wow. All right. So improving breath work, you know, and then you think about, if they're, and this is, you know, you actually think of the mechanics for the rowboat. They're going to be on, obviously, a seat that slides. You know, they're going to have, you know, access to these rows. So being able to come forward into this kind of hunch, almost like peanut type posture, and then being able to extend back. I look at it like hips, trunk, and neck are going to get absolutely fried. So when I started putting together a bunch of the training programs and just kind of assessing each guy individually, you know, are they strong enough and stable enough to be able to survive the task? And can we get them to do enough volume, hopefully? And that's another issue. And I know I wanted to dive into a little bit of the wearables, because I know you have a good background with that. And like, you know, how much can we really pull from the wearables to really be able to dictate the training? Because these guys aren't in front of us every day. I know with the pro BJJ guys I train, I see them 3-4-5 days a week. You know, I talk to their, you know, their coach. I go up and roll with them. They come and train with me. I have a whole bunch of like little like micro tests that I use every single time they come to train to figure out what their readiness is, and then try to get them to have their best day, regardless of what their training volume looks like, and then trying to peak them for different stuff. But I see those guys. So now we're running into a problem where the individuals that we're working with are remote in different places. So we're delivering training remotely, and we're going to use wearables to track them. Like, how much am I missing here?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that from the wearable standpoint, I'm most interested and engaged with the wearables in understanding what day-to-day habits are. Because again, as we're forming into teams, this is going to be so important. It's three guys on, three guys off the whole way. And so understanding things like, you know, what's happening to you in terms of heart rate variability, general biometrics after you've eaten a meal, a small meal versus a big meal. How much sleep are you getting? How much of that sleep is slow wave sleep? How much of it is REM, et cetera, helping us to understand who are the groups that should be paired together? Who are the folks that should be, who are like physiologically well suited to being working, rowing together, and who are the, you know, and who should we maybe not pair because they're incompatible, because these guys are going to do the after lunch shift and this one gets sleepy after eating. And so the wearable data, I think, is going to be super valuable for understanding all of those elements. I also think we need to really have a conversation around substances that these folks might take as part of their daily life, such as caffeine, mm-hmm. that really make that decision of, do you want to have caffeine pills on board or, you know, some source of caffeine, with the understanding that if it runs out or if it gets lost, you're going to start having headaches and feeling pretty droopy and maybe becoming constipated and all of these things. Or do you want to get off the caffeine six months out so that by the time you're ready to go, you're ready to go?
Wow. But, is there anything, obviously caffeine is I doubt these guys are going to be popping Ritalin and Adderall. So, I know that's kind of outside, and I wouldn't want those guys doing that just for the mere fact that I don't know how those more controlled drugs play into it. But, something like caffeine, I don't know how much coffee these guys are drinking, but was that one of the questions? Because I didn't necessarily address that. I didn't know if y'all addressed that when you're doing the basal metabolic.
Yeah. So we definitely addressed it at the sort of a baseline conversation, but we've also been having some conversations with the team about what the plan is, on the medical side. So it is, what are you taking?
Yeah, sure.
And what's the plan for when you're on the boat? Are you going to keep taking it? Are you going to stop taking it? What happens when you stop taking it? Okay. Do you want to go through that while you're on the boat, or do you want to go through that 3 months before you're on the boat? Those are conversations that have to happen, because for safety as much as anything, as much as performance.
Wow. Yeah, no, you're putting people into a situation where, you're talking anywhere from, I know ideally when the first group that did it, they were shooting for about 10 days. They went to 12 because of the high seas. And, now all of a sudden you're estimating for a certain amount of time. I know that food became an issue, water. And now all of a sudden, like you said, you're planning for something that looks like caffeine, or I don't know. I mean, what else would potentially be out there as maybe not a stimulant that's going to completely fry them, but just give them a little bit of like, hey, pep. Because here's the deal too. If you're rowing 90 minutes on, 90 minutes off, you're probably hoping that they're just kind of off their feet, resting, taking care of their hands, just kind of relaxing a little bit. So box breathing, meditation, all the other stuff. If you're having to basically pop some form of like, I don't know, go pill every 90 minutes on and off for the course of 10 to 12 days, I don't know if that lasts.
Yeah, I think two things. One of the things that Kirk Parsley and I spoke about with Judd is, honestly, with respect to the group that's done it, I'm not sure that 90 minutes on, 90 minutes off is optimal.
I said the exact same thing. How do you know it's 90 minutes? I mean, you have to test these guys to know, like, what if a guy can row for...
Absolutely. So...
Yeah.
And ideally, as we learned from Kirk, the sleep cycle, one sleep cycle is 120 minutes. So the ideal thing would be if we can make sure that in their rest period, they can get through one sleep cycle. I think that is going to boost their performance more than anything else, especially in the toward the end, mid to late event. When you speak to ultra endurance athletes and you speak to you know, elite military performers who have to do long range reconnaissance and things that require a lot of endurance. And you speak to even, believe it or not, long haul truckers who have a sort of a sense of having to do something that requires a lot of endurance. Often the thing that is really important is getting your body into a state of minimal changes. So, you know, you don't want any high highs and you don't want any low lows. Sure. You want to really create something that is pretty stable over time. And so, you know, the extent to which we're going to have these, you know, I don't think actually the right move is to have these go pills. I think the extent to which you can finish your shift, do a little bit of breathing, wind down and go straight to sleep, which for the record, I don't think sleep is going to be a problem for these guys. I could be wrong, but I think it's just going to be plop into exhausted sleep. Honestly, I think it's going to be toward the end, keeping them awake at the oars is going to be the trick. And so for there, I think with the extent to which they can engage in cold exposure and they can, you know, perk themselves up in a way that is a little bit more natural and climbs you up nicely, as opposed to dropping a caffeine pill and being up like this and then crashing. I really, really think that that is going to be the key, because again, we don't know about this. You know, one team's done it before, and there's not a lot of people out there who have experienced something like this before. But we have spoken to ultra endurance cyclists that have, you know, rode for 1600 miles and folks like that. And, you know, what they keep telling you is you just want your body to be in as stable a set of homeostasis as humanly possible throughout the days, because it's, if you try and push yourself, if you, you know, pop two caffeine pills, but then you get diarrhea, like, and then you start to get dehydrated and then all sorts of other issues, you know, wet pants and so on and so forth, start, you get skin breakdown. These are the things that really hold you up. So the best thing that you can hope for is stability across the 11 days.
Yeah, no, that, man, that's a great thought. I didn't think about the chance for dehydration and diarrhea. I mean, I was more focused on high season and some form of seasickness. You know, so like when I was talking to them, I'm like, you know, how many people here get seasick? Are there different ways? I know there's bracelets that you can wear with different like stress points, yeah, or reflex points. And I know they have them behind the neck. And obviously there's Dramamine and some other things that you can take. I've only got seasick one time. We went fishing when I was like maybe 13 or 14. And we ended up in like a kind of like, we were down in Cabo. We ended up in this big squall, and my brothers and I, or I think it was my dad and my brothers, all of a sudden, like the sea captain starts throwing out life preservers, and I saw the dude cross himself. Like
Jesus.
And I was like, oh shit. And next thing you know, we're like in 20, 30 foot, and it's the only time I've ever gotten sick. And ever since then, I've hated going on little boats. So we went to Costa Rica to go with my family. We decided to go fishing. I told my wife, I'm like, I'll go, but as long as it's not a little boat. It was a little tiny boat. And she's like, the whole time you look green. I'm like, we got bad flashbacks from this. But, you know, it was pretty awful. And even though I never got seasick before, like, you put yourself into that role and it just ends up putting you into a bad place. And that's what I was asking. I'm like, you know, how are we going to manage this piece? What happens if somebody gets sick? Like, how are we going to take care of all this? So I think there's a lot of variables. Actually, I have a call tonight with Judd and those guys, with some guys that have done some big open water paddle type stuff, just to kind of glean some more information and try to understand a little bit more about their testing and some physical waterfalls. You know, hey, it's 6 months out, it's 3 months out, it's 2 months out. What should they be able to do? What would be the expectation? You know, like, what tests could we do? Like, I know we talked about rowing for 90 minutes at like a 2:15 pace on the C2 rower. The other one the guys did was rowed on and off for an hour for 24 hours straight. So they rowed for an hour, rested for an hour, and basically had a certain amount of volume that they had to hit in that 24 hours to allow them to lock into the next place. So just being able to put some stuff together so that we have some metrics, because like I said, we're not seeing these guys every day. You know, we're going to come together for different training camps to test the boat. But when those people show up, we know that they're at a certain level. We've been monitoring everything. We know what it looks like. And, you know, and then the other issue is body weight. trying to make sure that they are the most efficient body weight, because extra pounds within the boat potentially slows you down and makes, you know, less food and some other things less able to come on, because there's got to be a weight limit. I mean, you can't just pack everything, so you have to be extremely strategic on keeping everything light and fast.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm actually dying to get my hands on the schematic of the boat, because we really want to get on that level of understanding where we're going to pack things, where we're going to stash things, and what we're going to do. But absolutely, you know, you can put all this effort into going 10, 15 pounds lighter on the food, but there's probably collectively 10, 15 pounds lighter that the crew could go if it's optimal.
Well,
absolutely.
I'm fascinated on the boat just from the mechanics. Like, I want to know how high it sits, like how it's all covered, you know, how stable it is. I mean, I was fortunate to work as a contractor for Naval Special Warfare, and I taught a bunch of seminars over in Hawaii for the SEAL delivery vehicles. And one of the first things they asked, or when we went in, we were going through the training, is like, I want to see the vehicles. And so they brought out these mini subs, which I thought like a sub would be enclosed. No, they're just like these vehicles that they go into, and then you have a mask and a, you know, obviously tanks and respirator. And then these guys will be like underwater for anywhere from 7 to 15 plus 20 hours, whatever it looks like underwater. And I'm like, you know, I scuba dived before. So I'm like looking at it, I'm like, how are you guys staying underwater that long? And they're like, oh, we got these Navy tables. They got this, all this wizardry. So I think, you know, you have these impossible tasks. And what's so amazing is there's like one niche dude, or like, you know, one company that this is what they do, and they're the world's experts, and they can answer these questions. Whereas, you know, we're sitting there like, how long of a boat? I know they talked about like 29 feet. Why 29 feet? Why is that the most efficient? And I'm like you, man, I want to see all the designs, and I'd love to know the thought process behind it all, just from a engineering standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as these guys progress on, what would be, you know, like, as the training goes on, you know, what would be something where like, hey, this guy might not be ready. Is it, you know, you know, like you said, like the daily load, they're not recovering, sleep looks worse. As we start adding volume, all of a sudden now their HRVs through is red. So I'm just wondering, like, what would be the potential red flags that we would have to see?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are definitely going to be physical red flags that range from, you know, the basic ones, you know. So as we start to build up load, and as we start to say, you know, exactly as you did, okay, let's do an hour on, an hour off for 24 hours, see how you do. Because you know, it's not perfect, but the beauty of this is that they can get on an ergo machine, they can sort of work at a certain load, and they can, to some extent, proxy the physical load that they're going to be going through. So it allows us to sort of say, okay, well, are you even in the ballpark of what we need from you? So at that point, if we're starting to see, okay, well, the 16th hour and this guy's hip is starting to click and become really painful, and then the next 2 days he can't walk, or we're seeing shoulder issues, or, you know, I want to be very, very cognizant of those sort of bodily red flags, because I think that that's something that can just abruptly end the expedition. If someone just physically can't move their shoulder anymore, you know, that's going to be an issue. So definitely those are some of the things that we're looking for. As well as you mentioned, we just need to see what happens to their sleep after they have, you know, such a enormous brutal load put on them for even the first 24 hours, then for a 2 day period, you know, just understanding what recovery looks like, so that we can optimize for them. We just don't know at this stage what we're going to see, but certainly, you know, it's pretty black and white in terms of physical capacity. If we're just seeing that people can't, you know, persist with what they need to do, that's going to be important. From a cognitive perspective, where we also need to be on the lookout for just, you know, good old fashioned teaming metrics, making sure that people are liking one another. This is close quarters for 11 days. You got to like You gotta like each other.
Yeah, no. If you're mad at the way some dude smells, we're gonna be in trouble.
Exactly. And making sure that these guys are bonding in a way that is going to lead to optimal sort of grit and resilience. Because, you know, as we discussed in the first camp, that resilience, we talk about it a lot, about these tough, resilient individuals, but really it's a social resource. And so the fact that you've got people around you that you know have your back, that's what makes you tough. That's what makes you resilient. And we need to make sure that the disconnect of not being able to train together all the time is overcome by good team bonding sort of woven into what's going on. And in terms of red flags, you know, I am going to take it, you know, and Paul Gronewall, who also came out, you know, we're going to take it pretty serious if we start to see fights breaking out, or, you know, text message banter getting a little bit aggressive leading up, because what we're going to need is a lot of positivity. We're going to need a lot of tight-knit bonding, because the assumption has to be that there are going to be moments in this event where everything goes wrong and everyone is miserable. And if you don't have that sort of tight-knit bond between the team, that's when the cracks are going to start to show. And again, fortunately, these are guys who understand deeply the importance of teaming. And so I think that we don't need to sell them on the importance, but it's going to be a very important feature.
Yeah, we, a number of years ago, we really got into, you know, here at Power Athlete, developing online fitness technologies and how to do strength and performance, and came on and helped pioneer an app called Train Heroic. And that's the way we deliver all of our training to the thousands of people around the globe that follow Power Athlete. We'll be delivering training via Train Heroic for these individuals, but then also using something like Discord, which, you know, there's training feeds and that with on Train Heroic, but they tend to stay very siloed into the training. Whereas recently I've been testing something like Discord to try to bring more community involved. And we're going to set up a Discord, which will allow them to, you know, talk some shit and have some fun, post some videos, and just create like more of a team environment. The one thing that we noticed with all the Power Athlete programs, and we have a catalog of them from like Jack Street, Grindstone, Field Strong, other ones, is that they're just siloed kind of team feeds. And then when we went to a general Power Athlete team feed, now all of a sudden we're getting this like amazing cross-pollination. And as this, I was looking for different ways for us to build, you know, continuity and just adherence. So like, hey, you know what, like, let's have a general training time where if, you know, you're going to row at 6, I'm going to row at 6. And like, you know, we can use other technologies like something like Discord or, you know, FaceTime or whatever it looks like to be able to record progress, post it up, and then be able to catalog it. And I think, something that really struck me with, when we were talking about the dark time of COVID, you know, everything went to this median of Zoom and, you know, obviously became very remote. And I'm coming to the realization that I don't know if it works as well for like team environments, but you know what, we're in a situation where that's what the cards were dealt. And, you know, doing things like training camp where you're bringing people in, there's a level of accountability, you're bringing in experts like yourself and, other people to really just show the magnitude and like the, you know, serious factor. Like we're not doing this to fuck around. We're not going out there to Disneyland to just row around in circles. We're trying to attempt a task that, you know, has killed more sailors. I mean, it's a reason that they built the Panama Canal was because they couldn't go around the Horn anymore. I mean, it's the most treacherous water ever. I mean, where three oceans meet. So to be able to go through that is not only an amazing talent, but I'm just fascinated to see what the training looks like in lead up, how we're able to balance the sleep, the nutrition, the team environment, get these guys physically fit and have the capacity and the resilience to be able to go out for, you know, somewhere between 10 and 12 days and basically row like a banshee to get across one of the gnarliest strips of water on the planet.
Yeah, absolutely. And, if anyone can do it, it's a team of former special operators, because, yeah, you know, like I said earlier, I feel like they have all of, you know, built into them, they have all of these qualities that we often think about as crucial to being able to push through these sorts of things. But, absolutely. I mean, I think everyone is starting to understand the enormity of the task. Even, you know, when I heard it the first time, I was like, oh, well, that sounds cool. And then I started, you know, researching it. I was like, okay, well, this is less cool and more insane. So, you know, and then I started reading more and I was like, okay, well, this is going to be a very challenging, you know, undertaking, and it's going to take everything we've all got. And so I'm starting to feel really encouraged, you know, meeting yourself and Kirk and like all of the, and Paul and all of the experts that they brought in, as well as, you know, the athletes. They have managed to assemble an all-star crew that might make it possible, but it really isn't possible without everyone working at 100%. So we need to be focused.
Yeah, no, I did kind of the exact same thing. So originally when, you know, Mike and Judd approached me about this, and it was on the calendar and I knew we were doing the training and they had explained it to me, but it wasn't until you guys showed up and I met you and I met the team and we were sitting in there talking about some of the psychological demands in this, that I went down and got on my computer and I'm like, okay, what is this exactly? And then started Googling and went through the path. And then, you know, obviously clicked in on the other team that had done it and then started kind of researching all their CVs and their backgrounds. And we had Colin O'Grady on the podcast. He had a book coming out called The 12-Hour Walk. And, you know, he had walked across Antarctica and he was one of the guys in this impossible challenge. So knowing him and then going through all the Red Bull stuff and just did like a deep dive and got an appreciation for it and was like, oh, shit. Like when you guys were here before, I didn't necessarily research the magnitude of what they were attempting. And that added a certain level of, what's the right word? Sense of urgency in me in terms of the training and connecting and doing all this, because, you know, at the end of the day, our job is to prepare these guys for an impossible challenge. So, I mean, we fail at the margins of our experience. So the more experience I can and the more we can extend our margins with finding, you know, other experts, like you mentioned, like Doc Parsley and yourself, and then, you know, obviously the breast stuff, which I'm super fascinated in. Side note on the breath stuff, I feel like breath training has become so uber trendy that like everybody now has a certification to the point where it just feels like bullshit snake oil, where I'm like, okay, here's another breath thing. And we had Brian Peters on, who's a former NFL player that teaches kind of hot and cold contrast and some breath stuff that I think is extremely valuable. And Kristen Wentz and some other people we've had on, but like it always, it feels very trendy now. And like, how are you measuring it? How is it repeatable? Like, I mean, we did VO2 max, we did lactic acid. Are we measuring CO2? How do we know our breath is improving? You know, I read Nestor's book, Breathe, and started taping my mouth when I slept. And like, my sleep is dramatically better. Like, I wake up at like 4:45, 5 a.m. completely rested and pop out of bed now. Whereas before, the alarm would go off and I'd feel real tired. My jaw would click and I knew I was mouth breathing because my mouth was super dry. Now taping my mouth, but I know it's helped me, but what if it doesn't help people? Or what's the mechanism and why is this so important? I mean, we got into the autonomics, we got into the para versus parasympathetic nervous system of mouth breathing versus this, but like, I'm like, what's the chemical reaction? Like, what is it? Is it CO2? Is our body not processing it? And then, you know, what are the determining factors for that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's why I'm really grateful that Josh Dunst jumped at this. I mean, first of all, in terms of expertise, you know, Josh will run rings around me when it comes to talking about autonomic nervous system and cold exposure and breath work through the nose and mouth taping and so on and so forth. But he's also a former special operator himself. So he was, he also worked in the Navy. He was in ordnance disposal. So pretty high stress gig.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
And so, you know, that was where he sort of entered the world of breath work, because he was trying to calm an autonomic nervous system that was jacked while he's trying to do something extremely delicate, in a bomb suit. So I think he comes at it from having a lived experience that most of the gents that are going to be on the boat can attest to and can, you know, connect with. But then his knowledge of physiology, his knowledge of the breathwork protocols that he teaches is very, very deep. So, you need to find the right coaches for this sort of thing. And you know, not just on a from a knowledge standpoint, because you can have all the knowledge in the world, but if you're not connecting with the team, you're not going to be an effective coach. But I think that we've really hit gold with Josh because he has that ability to connect with the team on a very visceral level.
Yeah.
You know, he's seen some of the things that they've seen, and then he can walk them through what's necessary. And you know, I think, you know, some of the stuff that Josh and I talk about in terms of outcome measures, I think the Whoop bands are going to be amazing for this, because you can see your heart rate variability change during breathwork protocols as you dampen down sympathetic activity and ramp up parasympathetic activity. So so heart rate variability and as well as heart rate will, you know, be able to guide these guys from a biofeedback standpoint as they're going through their breath work. And it's, you know, it's about as quantitative as you can get.
Are the wearables, I mean, I'm not as concerned with accuracy as I am with consistency with wearables. So I deal with this, you know, because we get hit up constantly within our programs, like, hey, I'm seeing this from this, and you know, it could be everything from like a Garmin to a Whoop to a Oura Ring. I mean, I've had like just about every wearable pushed at me, and you know, I'm wearing, you know, we had one guy that was wearing a Whoop band, and he's also wearing an Oura Ring, and the information was not linking up. And I'm like, well, yeah, but they're not sharing API. There's no like general algorithm that everybody's using to collect this stuff. They all have their scientists and their teams working to have the best product, and I guarantee they're not sharing. So there should be a discrepancy. If they were right on, I think I'd be a little more nervous. But my thing with him is like, you know, wear whichever one you feel is the most consistent. Like, I'm not necessarily over concerned with accuracy. I just want to know how consistent everything is so that I can measure progress over time, more so than like, you know, this one says my heart rate's 58 and this one says it's 48. I'm like, okay, well, you know, obviously I'm better shape on this one. And I'm like, yeah, but like, let's look at over time. So I think people get really wrapped around the axle on these like small acute kind of measurements, whereas it's similar to blood work, you know? I started getting my blood work done twice a year, I think in like 2001, and I've gone to the same doc, and obviously the tests have changed over time. Like it went from Quest Labs and now it's LabCorp, and they have values in this, but to be able to like put that in, and what he does is he takes all the blood work and all the markers and we test the same ones, and then I can see trends over time. Whereas, you know, somebody gets blood work and they hit me up for a consult and I, you know, go over and we put some strategies together to increase their sleep and maybe, you know, look at their training volume and, you know, supplementation and diet and maybe some extra testing. But at the end of the day, you're just giving me a snapshot of one moment in time. And, you know, without seeing, you know, trends over time, I don't know how you can make an educated decision. So I'm excited that these guys are getting a wearable. We'll start being able to track, and now we can start looking at like consistency over time. And there's a little adherence to it, where if they're not hitting their training markers, we're going to know real quick.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm right there with you. I mean, I think that sticking with the wearable that gives you the most sensitivity to change in the system is what we should be shooting for, and it's going to be different with every different person. You know, basically, you know, two of the most important features of all of these wearables tends to be, you know, goodness of fit of the technology. So how well does this technology, either if you're using a ring, is it fitting on your finger, or is it a little bit, you know, is it rotating around? How well do you tolerate this thing being pretty tight on your finger versus swinging around on your finger loosely, and you know, same with a wristwatch. So the fit really matters, because that creates artifact in the ability to measure. And then skin tone. Most of these technologies utilize you know, light technology going through the skin. If your skin is darker, it works less well. Really, it just comes down to finding the technology that is giving you the most sensitivity to change, you know, across your own goals. So that if you're putting in consistent effort on a training and you're seeing consistent changes, you can be confident that those changes are real. But yeah, I totally agree with you. I can certainly put on an Oura Ring and put on a Whoop band or whatever, and get two completely different readings. And, you know, and that's just going to be the way of the world because of how sensor technology works.
So you also brought up skin tone, but one of the ones that we ran into when we tested some of the wearables, like the bigger and thicker you are, like my wife's, for example, was like accurate with everything. We went and got BMR testing done. So she knew her basal metabolic rate. She was tracking all of her calories, and hers was like 97, 98% accurate compared to what we were doing. And she was weighing herself. And we did that. My wife is a little OCD, so she's extremely detailed. So like, she's my control for everything. I'm like, all right, if she can, like, let's manage this against her. And, you know, she weighs herself, so she knows exactly how many calories, and she's super efficient. So hers was good. Mine was literally like so inaccurate. It had me basically burning about 9,000 calories a day. And at the time I was eating about 3,000. And so I would have been in a 6,000 calorie deficit, which, you know, would have been 2 pounds. I mean, roughly, you know, 2¾ pounds a day. And I did that for months on end. And like, you know, I wasn't dead. So,
yeah.
And then when we reached out, you know, they made an issue that like sometimes for bigger dudes with more muscle, more like just meat and tissue in the arm, it might not be as accurate, like, let's say, as like a, you know, 115, 120 pound, you know, woman like my wife, who might have thinner skin and maybe not as much muscle in her forearm.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, everything matters, right down to, we had a conversation just the other day with, I do performance for an esports team called the Quad Gods. They're made up entirely of quadriplegics following a spinal cord injury. And we had, you know, a rep from Apple say, let's give them all Apple Watches. And I'm like, vascular system is very different. Like putting an Apple Watch on their wrist isn't going to work out the way you think it does. So, but you know, that's one end of the spectrum,
yeah.
But you still have people in the middle of, you might have Raynaud's phenomenon, which means, you know, vasospasm occurs in your hands. Aura Ring is not going to be for you because, you know, it's trying to get a stable measurement from the flow of blood in and out of your vascular system. So it's everything matters. And it's all about finding the right one that works.
How, for an E, I guess like a E competition for quadrupeds, how do they use the head eye movement? Like, I mean, if their arms and legs aren't moving, is it like neck?
And so we've got, so it's, six guys, five guys and one female participant and, athlete, I should say. And, they all have their own setup. So some of them have the ability to move their arms and their hands a little bit. So we set up buttons and switches and adaptive joysticks that they can use. Two of the team members have no movement of their arms. So they have a device called a quad stick, and it's kind of a joystick that they can put into their mouth. And by sipping and puffing and moving their head around, they can get quite a lot of control of a gaming console. And these guys are competitive. They're like, you know, entering competitions and winning prize money. So
damn,
it's good work.
We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Are you pushing through performance roadblocks caused by pain or janky movement mechanics? Knock the rust off with our movement health courses, used by thousands of athletes worldwide, from average Joes to MVPs. Our courses give you the tools to assess and fix yourself so you can get back to breaking necks and cashing checks. Not convinced? Get a taste of how our courses can help you by enrolling in a free sample today. Head to powerathletehq.com and search courses from the menu. Now back to the show. I'm always fascinated by technology in terms of being able to make up for these deficits. Like one of the most fascinating things to me is, and I know this is pretty awful, but you know, obviously we were in a war in this country for 20 years and a lot of guys lost limbs. So over the years, when I was teaching the CrossFit football seminars and also a power athlete, we would come up across somebody who was, you know, missing a leg, missing an arm. And I was always weirdly fascinated by the technology and like their ability, like what was created to have them adapt, like carbon fiber hinges, titanium. I think personally, like there should be no budget and no expense spared to like get these people back. If you go and you lose, like there's groups that do this, but I was so fascinated by the carbon fiber. And then also the difference between below the knee amputees, above the knee amputees. Like if you're below the knee, I mean, they can pretty much just like stick something on there. And as long as the ankle has movement, those guys have such a better outcome. The minute that you go above the knee, now all of a sudden you're talking about artificial deal. You know, there was another guy where, you know, it was up into the hip. So this whole thing strapped into him. And now he's got, you know, one, two, and three joints opposed from just, you know, one joint, like an ankle. How they created, you know, the feet and the toes. I mean, like, I was just more fascinated by the technology piece. And then obviously with the gaming, like the things that they're able to do. And, you know, I'm just super stoked that there's outside the box thinkers that come in and are like, this is a problem I can solve. And, you know, to me, it looks insurmountable when you put the technology to it. But yeah, I mean, running into these guys that have, there was one guy that obviously lost an arm and they had different attachments for hands for him to do pull-ups and lift weights and do this. And he could throw and he would just swap out his attachment. And I'm like, dude, that is the coolest thing I think I've seen. You know, I'm sorry that, you know, you're going through this, but I mean, it's pretty neat. Like you got cool attachments. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I come from the same standpoint of, if you're injured in a conflict, defending your country, your country should be sparing no expense to looking after you. And doing a little bit of work with the VA myself, we get to work with a lot of folks that you know, get access to these technologies after an injury. And you know, it's fascinating not only from the technology standpoint, what is possible with the technology. But also one of the things, and this is something that we study a lot in our lab, is, you know, this tipping point of how much the technology is worth investing the effort. You know, for instance, there's for folks who have lost an arm, there are some really advanced upper extremity prosthetics that you can get. But, you know, it takes 3, 4, 5 months sometimes of training to really work how to use this thing properly. And you know, you give most veterans the option. They're like, yeah, just give me the hook. You know, I can do 99% of what I need to do with a hook and, you know, and a couple of attachments on the end of a hook. I don't need the fancy robotic thing. That's, you know, I don't need to spend 5 months learning how to use that. And understanding that level of like, you know, how much value you get from how much investment of time is always super interesting to me as well.
No, I'm in complete agreement that if you're going to send people to war, when you bring them home, you have to take care of them and you have to, you know, try to return them, you know, in the best condition in which they showed up. I mean, and I realize people are going to get hurt and it's a nasty deal. So then you have a responsibility to take care of those people. I also view the NFL the same way that, you know, if you're going to ask these guys and, you know, even though people see the big salaries, a lot of these guys leave like little broken toys and they get cast off to the island of misfit toys and never to be seen again. And I have worked and met and talked and spoke with a ton of ex NFL players that have a ton of cognitive issues and, you know, can't get out of their own way to be able to do this. And so a big part of my journey over the last, you know, 10 years in terms of retirement in the NFL was, more importantly, putting protocols together to not only fix myself, but when other people approach me, being like, here's what I did to effectively, you know, allow myself to recover from any of the impacts. And in 2013, this was actually through Naval Special Warfare, they were doing a DOD study looking at EEGs, like basically brain mapping, to try to find like if there was a certain brain type that availed itself to, you know, tier one door kicking operators. And they were trying to figure out how they could clean up the pipeline. So a bunch of the guys that we worked with kept coming up and getting tested in Newport. And I ended up going over and meeting them just because I'm fascinated by this stuff. The doc ends up meeting me and it's like, oh, you played in the NFL for a decade. We'd love to get you in and scan your brain. So they scan it. And the brain map that I had was actually the map that they were looking for, which is like they call it like operator brain or CEO brain, right? It had whatever the characteristics. So everything looks great. They did some heat mapping and the part of my brain that was damaged when I played was over here on the left frontal lobe. So obviously that like didn't light up the same way. So you could see like a kind of a big spot for that. But ironically, Nick Hardaway could play center for the San Diego Chargers. He's retired. He came in. He was having some brain issues and started working with this group. Where they were using magnets to kind of rebalance some of the mapping and kind of help alleviate, you know, depression and lack of sleep and some other deals. So he comes in for South by Southwest to present with the doctors and sit on a panel on brain health. So he invites me to come, and I have this really steadfast deal with myself where if like another NFL player or professional athlete reaches out and they want me to go to something, I go. Professional athletes tend to be very flaky and even more flaky in retirement where they just like don't do shit. They won't pick up the phone. They won't do stuff. So I told them, if you're speaking, dude, I'll be there to support you. So I was. The guy gets up and he starts presenting and I'm like, shit, this information is so familiar. So I go up and I meet the doc after and I'm like, man, about 10 years ago, I was in a study. Met these guys that were doing a DOD study and I explained it with, you know, at this brain research center. And the guy's like, that's us. You know, the doctor you worked with is no longer with us. He's since retired, I've taken over his research. So he invited me to come the next day to get scanned. And when I showed up, he's like, we were able to pull your original scans out of the study. So we have this, and he's super stoked. We've never had like 10 years between this. I mean, our tech hasn't changed and you haven't, you know. And so he scans me and all of a sudden they overlay them. And the results were pretty amazing in that the last 10 years, basically my peak had moved back this way, which means I found a way to de-age my brain. The peak actually went higher and was more narrow. So he's like, you know, in 10 years, you've somehow figured out how to de-age your brain, make it more efficient and make yourself smarter. And the mapping that we had on the other side where we showed damage 10 years ago no longer exists.
Oh, that's so incredible.
Yeah. So the doctor at first was like, did we make a mistake? And the guy's like, no, this is what we're seeing. So, you know, and like, I mean, we've had Dr. Joe DiRudi on, who's like the expert on hyperbarics. And I went through his hyperbaric protocol. You know, we had, we got Dr. Phil Yu coming on, who's probably like the foremost expert right now in stem cells and exosomes, which I went and had exosomes done at his center. So, I mean, like, things like ketogenic diets and lifting weights and insulin sensitivity and maintaining muscle and exercise and zone 1, zone 2 and aerobic fitness and mitochondrial density and, you know, everything from like, you know, doing practice LSAT exams to trying to learn foreign languages or, you know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu or fighting. I mean, like all of these things go play into this like holistic approach for brain health and this. And, you know, the doctor sat down, he's like, well, what have you done? I'm like, what haven't I done in the last 10 years to try to make myself better? But what happens is people get siloed into this and they're just like, nothing can be done. And I think what this long story is getting back to is if there is a task or there's something to accomplish, we can put the steps together if you put the right individuals in play and you bring in enough really sharp people that are willing to work in a team. I don't think that there's any task that is insurmountable that we cannot execute.
Totally agree. And, you know, everything that you've been saying is resonating so strongly with a lot of the work that we do with traumatic brain injury and mild cognitive impairment, where in everybody with these issues, but especially in veterans, you know, they will, it's often, I can't think of a crueler way to treat people who have lived or died by working in teams and working in a social network. They come home, the team is dispersed. You then say, you've got a cognitive injury. There's not a lot we can do, but here's something for anxiety and here's something for depression. And, you know, we'll see you in a few months. And then these people go home alone. They don't have a social network anymore, you know? And they're told, look, your brain damaged. That's it. You know? Whereas, you know, after several $1 billion of drug development to try and come up with a solution for cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's and so on and so forth, the best thing that we can say right now is moderate intensity aerobic exercise and social connection are the two things that demonstrably slow cognitive decline in people with a brain injury or with Alzheimer's disease. And then as you start to actually follow the science of some of these emerging areas, hyperbaric oxygen and, yeah, you know, intervention with exosomes and actually going beyond just moderate intensity aerobic, but moving into different aerobic zones. These things are there. They're just not being, you know, they're not being mainstreamed because it's, you know, it's expensive and it's complicated and you need a team. You know, I think that as we approach, you know, I think, you know, the next challenge for us in both performance and medicine is to move away from this reductionist, like, just, you know, if you're an athlete, throw yourself against the wall over and over again and only the strong will survive. And if you're a patient, this is your disease and this is your medicine. No, I think we need to move toward, highly comprehensive interdisciplinary care models that that really leverage teams of people working together, as opposed to, going it alone.
Well, I think our society fits with this idea of, just take this pill. Just do this one thing, where it's a holistic approach, and it takes consistency and effort and time. Like everybody, like, oh, I have this issue. Take this pill. How is it going to affect me? And I never took that deal. I looked at it like, if you can provide the best environment, remove the stress, and then do little things that keep coming on, and just was this constant move. The exosome deal was really interesting. I think they hit me with like a few trillion exosomes in an IV. And it was in the morning, and then later that afternoon, all of a sudden it was like I had this like warm buzzing feeling, and I couldn't explain it, almost like I'd had a drink, but I hadn't had a drink. And all of a sudden, like we were having a conversation, and it was as if like maybe whatever fog I might've had just got wiped clean. And my ability to like create information and talk, like to the point where I was like looking around, and I make the joke, I felt like I did before I started playing in the NFL. It was like a snap of the finger. And that warm buzz lasted for like 6 months. And like, it was noticeably different. And then we had Dr. Joe on the podcast, and he went through all the hyperbaric research. And like, I mean, if you're really looking about something that's legitimately life extension that can say, this is de-aging you and creating a longer life, it's the hyperbarics and the telomere lengths and all this research. So I'm like, let's give it a shot. He found me a local guy and I ended up doing the 40 sessions, which was 5 days a week for 8 weeks, which is extremely difficult to execute. But I committed to do it. I promised the guy I would do it. And I never want to, obviously go back on my word in that way. But that was extremely beneficial. The hyperbarics was another one where all of a sudden I felt like the cobwebs at about 20 sessions, like just cognitively, everything just seemed to be really sharp. My writing improved, just like everything improved. So I think those two big ones. But also, obviously the diet that we follow is very close to a paleo diet. I mean, it's basically off of like, one ingredient. I try to cook every meal. We source everything from like, bitchin' local, and I'm very fortunate in that way. But the other big one, and we had, I think it was Gabrielle Lyon on the podcast talking about like protein and muscle being, an organ for the body and for like, mental longevity, and especially for brain health, the greater amount of muscle you can carry in relation to fat, the greater chances you have of longevity, because fat's extremely oxidative, ages the brain, muscle's extremely insulin sensitive, which allows the brain to not be as exposed. And I've heard people talk about Alzheimer's being type 3 diabetes, and I've heard that connection, and it's very real. So, lifting some weights, having a good aerobic base, and, just being very fortunate to get plugged in with some amazing people on this podcast has provided me with such dividends. And when people reach out, I'm like, there is a path for this, but it's a path of self-discovery. It's not just one thing. Somebody's just not going to hand you a pill, not just put you on a diet or just do one thing. It's going to be consistency, like we talked about with the wearables. Everybody's searching for this like acute, what did this number tell me? But if it's tracking consistency over time, how is it giving us data to allow us to continue to improve?
Absolutely. And we tend toward these reductionist outcome measures. I mean the culture, whether it be the medical culture or the media culture, do these three things to become ripped and jacked, and it's like we love these little lists. What's the three things I can do? What's the five things I can do, over and over and over again. But ultimately, exactly as you said, it's self-discovery. You need to know yourself. You need to know your body well. You need to understand why, if you're not performing at the level that you want to be performing at, why that could be the case, and really sort of sleuth it down and work out what's going on. We're learning so much right now. My lab has really, since the pandemic, focused a lot on long COVID, as well as some of the things that, we've been studying in the performance area and neuroscience area. And as, the deeper we look, the more damage we're seeing that this virus does to the whole body. And, one of the things that was really striking to me was we learned about a lab in South Africa that was showing that these tiny clots were forming in the blood of people with long COVID, and they weren't forming in the blood of people who didn't have long COVID. And so we started looking, and sure enough, we see these clots, and they're blocking vascular structures. And so then we started looking into specific enzymes like natokinase and lumbrokinase that can break these clots up. And, you know, a proportion of our patients who have these clots, if they take the enzymes, especially if they take them early enough, because sometimes if they've had it for 3 years, it's a bit harder to clear the clots. But if they take it early, it breaks up the clots and a lot of their function returns. And, you know, and you talk to a cardiologist or a hematologist about natokinase, lumbrokinase, they look at you like you just fell out of a tree. They're like, what is this stuff? And what are microclots, you know? But it's not easily, you know, accessible knowledge. But surely enough, as we, you know, I think what we need to accept as we move into performance science and as we move into medicine is what we take as, you know, these mainstream tests that we run, that we take as like the sort of blueprint for health. It's such a limited subset of what is going on in our physiology, from cellular function and vascular function and, you know, and cognitive function. We should not be resting on our laurels right now. There is so much more we need to learn.
Just for my lack of knowledge, I mean, long COVID versus short COVID. I mean, what is, like, is that the difference? I mean, obviously, you know, we lived through this entire COVID deal, which is pretty wild to me in that, I've had people that have had probably four or five different bouts with COVID, and I've had zero. So I've never had COVID, and I've had my antibodies, haven't tested in like the last 6 months, but we've been tested numerous times and never had any antibodies. And I've been exposed. I sat in this podcast room with a guy who coughed on me for 2 days who had COVID and who's had it a number of times. So I find it interesting where all of a sudden you have people that are fine in 3 days. And then, like you said, the long hauls deal, which was, I first heard about it from Dr. Joe DiRudi, who was doing research where they were using hyperbarics to actually work with people that are having long hauls. I think he called it long haul syndrome, but I'd love to get in and understand a little bit about the differences and how it's affecting people.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a huge challenge, and we're working to understand the pathobiology, you know, like what is the biology behind the pathology of long COVID. But you know, in the simplest terms, in the folks who had, you know, there are folks who have long COVID who had severe acute disease. You know, they ended up on a ventilator and they have organ damage and they're struggling to recover. But then there's folks who had the mild disease. You know, they didn't get hospitalized. Maybe they got pretty sick, but they didn't have to go into the hospital, and they got over it on their own. But then they got over the acute illness, and then they sort of transition into this post-acute illness that just lingers, and they sort of can't get out of bed. They can exert themselves, but if they exert themselves, they pay for it. What we're starting to see is this cycle in these folks of viral persistence. So the virus doesn't clear the body, it stays. That leads to a few things. So first of all, it leads to mitochondrial dysfunction, because viruses don't have their own mitochondria. They attach onto your cells. They use your cells' mitochondria to create energy so that they can replicate. And so then they put you into energy deficit. So we're seeing mitochondrial dysfunction in these folks. In addition to that, you've got a virus rushing around your body. You get systemic inflammation. You get immune exhaustion because your body is trying to fight this thing. It's doing it for 3 or 4 years. Now you're starting to, your immune system's starting to get ragged, which then causes latent virus reactivation. So if you've had herpes virus, Epstein-Barr, these things come back. And then the other thing that we've seen is that these persistent viral fragments, and this is now all, you know, published, settled science. You know, we're seeing
No, I know this is all truth. I mean, this isn't conjecture. I love that anything that has to do with like COVID and this and the effects. I mean, it feels like when the COVID thing was happening, I'm sure you saw this, like everybody was a virologist. I'm like, this is like, I defer to people like Doc Parsley and, people that are really, that do this stuff for a living. I mean, Brett Weinstein and his brother, studied bats. I listened to a podcast with them and he's like, oh yeah, no, coronaviruses and bats. This was our research. I have a PhD in this. I tend to take people's advice who have studied this and do this. And and then what's amazing is then you have social media where it's like everybody's an expert. And I'm like, man, I didn't know that so many of you guys studied virology.
I know,
and I'm sure you're in the same deal where you're like, well, this is what we're doing. But what I still can't figure out, and maybe it's just like this with everything, 80 to 90% of all men are either going to die of a heart attack or cancer. If you are in pretty good aerobic shape and you sauna 5 days a week, I mean, the Finn saw that your chance of cancer or a heart attack go to almost zero. So now we just got to deal with cancer. And, Tom Inkledon, the guy I mentioned earlier, they're doing a bunch of research with cancer and they found that exercise is by far their best ally in putting out killer cells that basically disrupt cancer. And he's like, cancer weakens people to the point where they can't move and then it just takes them down. If they can get these people into exercise regimens, everything seems to work. And if the people are super fit, I mean, we've seen this with like NFL players that all of a sudden get a lymphoma, whatever, all of a sudden they deal with it. And within like a few months, they're fine because they were so physically active, so strong and so fit that they were allowed to do it. So Tom's deal has always been like, if you can do something like aerobic exercise, train, do all these things, maybe do some sauna and continue to train at a high level, focus on your diet, manage things that come up, avoid smoking, excess alcohol and, a bunch of the myriad of drugs that they try to hand out. He's like, you have a pretty good chance to getting as far as you can, but eventually people wear out. But I'm just more fascinated, that you could take, if you were to like magically release a, COVID virus in this room with a bunch of people, why is it that, I mean, and maybe you don't know, I'm sure you do, but it manifests in so many different ways between everybody. I mean, everybody's biology is different, but I sit here and it doesn't even affect me. And the other guy's on, has a cough for 2 days and another guy's in the hospital with a respirator. I still have always found that really fascinating.
Yeah. And I mean, we're still trying to understand why, people have differences in who's going to get long COVID versus who's not. I've now seen over 3,000 cases of long COVID, and it ranges from folks who had severe autoimmune disease all the way through to people who are, running their 10th marathon and, super fit and not a worry in the world in terms of
pre-existing conditions, like wasn't a determining factor for long COVID.
Not at all. It could affect anyone. And whereas in acute COVID, a lot of the sort of determination of severity really rested on density of ACE2 receptors in your body, because the ACE2 receptors were how the virus got into the cell. And so if you were, there was this early paper which got me worried because I was working frontline. They were like, if you're balding, you're at higher risk of severe acute disease because more testosterone means more ACE2 means the viral load. If you get hit, if me and someone with lower testosterone, my wife are sitting in the same room and we both get hit with the same dose of COVID, less of it is going to make its way into her cells because she has less ACE2 receptors.
So were they saying higher testosterone because obviously the DHT is associated with the hair loss. So what they were saying is that the higher testosterone, higher conversion of DHT would make you more susceptible to COVID.
Correct. Because it also co-occurs with higher ACE2 receptor density. So you've got more of these receptors on your cell, more of the virus gets in, you get sicker. And so we were starting to understand all of these things. And certainly there's still a study ongoing in LA where they're, you should, if you make your way out there, you should give some blood. They're looking for the blood of people who have never been infected because they think that there's a certain, percentage of people in the population who just have this natural resilience to coronaviruses that is protecting them. And then, of course, there's just general immune health and, certain people in a, you know, certain people never get sick. You know, I find myself fairly fortunate in that I had a direct exposure over a long period of time. You know, the one and only time I've gotten COVID was I shared a house with someone who was infected, and we didn't know until after, and it still took, you know, 7 or so days to get infected. And I haven't had COVID since, you know, so I think that a few of us have, you know, we just have a level of fortune in terms of our immune health that makes it harder for us to get sick, and good for us. But yeah. There's unfortunately folks that this hit really, really hard. And then certain folks can't clear the virus. And you know, one of the cruelest elements of this is because it affects your ability to produce energy so profoundly, it's one of these illnesses where you can't exercise your way out of it. Every time you expend energy, you go into oxidative stress and you start feeling worse. And so we've had to be really careful with our long COVID patients, because any level of exertion will put them into a flare that leaves them bedbound for a few days. So it's been a rocky road trying to work out how to treat. But, you know, on the flip side, we have learned so much so quickly about things like hyperbaric oxygen therapy, mitochondrial supplementation, vagus nerve stimulation, cold exposure, breath work, et cetera.
This isn't official, but I think I'm the longest continuous creatine user on the planet. I started taking creatine when I was like 15 or 16. So 1992, wow. The old power lifter that trained us had a nutrition deal, and he's like, "Hey, I want you to take this stuff." And so we'd take five, you know, a teaspoon in the morning, teaspoon at night for like 10 grams. And I've done that pretty much every single day. I mean, obviously I've missed days over the, you know, go on vacation and haven't really taken, you know, but for the most part, maybe other than maybe a handful of days in a row, if we were on vacation, like every day I've trained, I've taken it, took it all through the NFL. So I'm 47 now. So I was probably 15 or 16. So I got like 31, 32 years of taking 10 grams of creatine every single day. For over 30. And now all of a sudden, you know, back then they were like, "Oh, it's going to give hamstring pulls and this." Looking at the research, the cognitive effects for the brain as a neuroprotectant are well established, and also for ATP for energy and mitochondria. Now all of a sudden all this incredible research, Andy Galpin just posted a really killer research deal where they were talking about increased, not necessarily like more dense bones, but the people that take creatine have a different, thicker, more favorable bone profile than those that didn't. And he kind of went through all these different stuff. And like, I've been telling people this for years, and they actually, the testing they did was at 10, whereas the 3 to 5 is what most people take. And I like clicked on there and I was like, 10 grams of creatine every single day, or pretty damn close for over 30 plus years. And I have always thought that the creatine might have starved off some of the issues, obviously played in the NFL cognitively, but also maybe have been a protectant. And not that I'm throwing this stuff out there, but also, you know, I'm pretty consistent on testing my vitamin D levels. So mm-hmm. when we started training the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu guys, you know, they're obviously from Brazil around the equator. And I read a pretty cool piece of research where they talked about people of darker skin from the equator, when they come to, you know, places even like Texas, which has a lot of sun, are extremely low in their vitamin D, which prevents them from putting on muscle and training at high intensities. So I reached out to Thorne, got a bunch of vitamin D tests. All those guys were low, started hitting them with big doses of vitamin D. And all of a sudden, like you would have thought that they were all taking steroids. They were like, "Dude, we feel amazing. Like, what's in this stuff?" And I'm like, no, it's fine. You're just having optimal vitamin D levels, but we've always optimized for vitamin D. That's one of the tests that I've done year in, year out. So I always think that the creatine and the vitamin D was a major player. I don't necessarily have any scientific backup, but if you're talking about mitochondrial density and being able to, you know, have this appropriate, but like I said, I've been exposed numerous times to where we've been out to dinner, we've gone to events or whatever, and then the people call us a day later and it's like everybody tested positive. And my wife's like, "You think this is your turn?" And I've been like, "No." And then I've gone every 6 months to try to get the antibody test, and I keep coming back negative. So I don't know if maybe being 6'6", like I'm so much taller than people. That's what my wife thinks. She's like, "Maybe you're just in a slightly different atmosphere where people cough, it's hitting your shirt, and maybe it's not getting into your nose." And I was like, it's not a bad theory. I don't know if it's going to work in the same way. I mean, it's obviously airborne, But yeah, I think that we were extremely beneficial. But we also, you know, live out here in the middle of Texas, and you've been to the ranch, obviously. You know,
yeah.
So I mean, we're pretty fortunate in our surroundings, in that we're not jammed into a apartment building with thousands of people. Like whenever I see China, and like those people jammed in those like massive apartment buildings that have like 5,000 people in each one, I think to myself, man, this is central ventilation. I mean, this must just spread like wildfire.
Yeah. Absolutely. Population density across the world, you know, that's why New York got hit so hard when we were here in March of 2020. It's just it's going to be the biggest kicker for, you know, for viral spread.
Well, I mean,
I'm wishing you guys luck that
keep the streak keep alive. I also have a feeling that, and I think you know with viruses, that as they replicate, they tend to weaken. So I remember when, you know, COVID originally hit, like the decimation in Italy, I remember especially, was like everybody was dying. And, you know, I think when you see something of that magnitude, and, you know, these, you know, and like, I have a hard time believing that like people were nefarious in the lockdowns and it was some like, you know, Orwellian way to take advantage. I think it was just a lot of people that had no idea what to do because we'd never faced this, just making a whole bunch of real time bad decisions. And just trying to do their best to cover their ass. And, but you know, people like, you know, cause you run into people like, oh, this COVID thing's bullshit. I'm like, it wasn't. If you go back and you look at like the severity of when that first hit in Italy, I mean, they lost a huge section of their population over the age of 60. Like they tour buses of people were going down with it.
Yeah, no, look, we were, you know, I'm a rehab, you know, rehab specialist. And so we were working on the rehab ward and we were having 8 to 10 people a day dying on our ward. You know, so it's, you know, in rehab, no one dies. Like but during COVID, we just had so many sick people. There were, you know, we saw firsthand the decimation. There, you know, it always, you know, I'm from Australia and I had a lot of Australian friends being like, well, is it really that bad? Because we're pretty locked down, you know, like I'm more specifically from Western Australia where they had a hard border, they had strict lockdown laws. And until everyone was vaccinated, they had no community transmission of COVID through 2 years. And so I would be looking at, you know, what's going on in Perth. And it's like, life is normal. There's football stadiums and, you know, because they had zero COVID.
Yeah.
And you know, my friends and family there were like, so yeah, it doesn't seem that bad. I'm not sure that this thing is real. And I'm like, there are, you know, five alarms going off.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I assure you, this is very real and very terrible. But it's hard to imagine that level of devastation when you're not in it, is the bottom line.
Ironically, where I go to jiu-jitsu, Six Blades, up in North Austin, there was about 30, maybe not 30, maybe 25 people from Perth that came and visited. That have been rolling with us every day. They've been coming to class and they go around and like, I guess they're on like some jiu-jitsu pilgrimage to go train because Austin's kind of considered like the mecca for jiu-jitsu now with, you know, Gordon Ryan and, you know, John Danifer's, you know, New Wave and then, you know, Shandy's Six Blades. And it's just become this epicenter for it with like Flo being here. And so these guys all showed up and they were all from Perth. And I was getting a chance to rap with them last night a little bit about it. And they were like, you know, the hardest thing, because Australians tend to travel, whereas Americans do not travel. Like, that's just not what they do. I mean, the amount of Americans that I've met been like, oh, like when they talk to me, they were like, oh, you know, you've been to Perth? I'm like, yeah, we've been all over Australia. I taught a number of seminars. We went from the Gold Coast, Melbourne, Sydney, Perth, all over. And they were like, you know, the amount of Americans that have like, wow, I've never been to Australia, but they all want to go, but never do. And he's like, you know, whereas, so they said that the hardest thing was sitting there seeing the world play out and not being able to travel to, you know, Bali and the Philippines and Thailand and this and like, you know, some of their usual meccas. And the guys were like, you know, we've been waiting to take this adventure to Austin to be able to go train. And they were all great. And if I didn't have kids to run home with, I would have gone on a beer with them last night, but maybe on Wednesday I'll be able to. But it was super cool that they all showed up in this group. They were all there. And when I asked them, I'm like, you know, how was COVID for you guys? How was it? Their hardest part was like not being able to travel and go see the world, that like we had to be stuck in one place. Whereas I think for a lot of the Americans, they were probably relieved to be stuck in one place and not have to travel or go to work and like this remote working deal. So it's just, yeah, it was good dudes, but yeah, just small little deal that, you know, Perth, which, you know, it's kind of like 80s San Diego. I mean, what an interesting place in response to, like, you know, obviously, like, you know, Sydney and Melbourne, some of the bigger places we went.
80s San Diego is such an apt description of Perth. I love that.
Yeah, that's what it looked like. I remember, I grew up in Southern California. I mean, I was born in the late 70s, but like in the 80s, like San Diego, small town, water, beach. I was like, this is kind of like 80s San Diego. Like, I could totally just move here. You know, so and the people were super friendly, which was great. So but I've always gotten along with the Australians just because they, you know, want to have some drinks. And, you know, also being a big dude, they're always like more excited to like, oh, this guy can, you know, if we get in a fight, he can help. So so what's on the horizon for the lab? I mean, as I was going through your website, which, it, you know, I saw obviously the COVID, the long haul and all the testing, like what's on the horizon for the lab?
Well, we've got a lot of really exciting stuff. We are, you know, continuing to do a lot of work with long COVID, which and other post-viral illnesses and Lyme disease and things like that, which is a total new direction for us. And I'm just learning as quickly as I can about all of these things.
Lyme disease in Texas and also New Jersey, I mean, because of the deer and all that, is like, I mean, ravages people.
It's unbelievable and incredibly tragic the way it can just take folks apart. It's really, really challenging, and we're just diving into the challenge. We're excited to learn and see what we can do to offer help, and we are definitely going off the beaten path, you know. So a lot of the techniques that we've been talking about is are going to come into play, and they're definitely not mainstream approaches to treatment. So super excited about all of that. We also on the neuroscience side of things, we're doing a lot of work with brain computer interfaces. So we've actually now implanted three individuals with a completely novel brain implant for folks who are completely locked in with ALS, so Lou Gehrig's disease or motor neuron disease. We've implanted them with a device from a company called Synchron, which can record brain activity as they're sort of initiating it. So they try and think about moving their foot, and we can map that notion of trying to move your foot onto a mouse click. So, you know, try and move your left foot, that's a left mouse click. Try and move your right foot, right mouse click. And now we've got three of these folks controlling a phone with their brain activity and being able to sort of control their environment a little bit with, you know, smart house technology, giving them back a little bit of agency and allowing them to sort of communicate and interact with their family members. So getting very excited about this implantable technology and what it can do. So brain computer interfaces, epidural spinal stimulators, we're working on those to help people who have lost function as a result of stroke or spinal cord injury and bringing it back, and a lot of different prosthetic work. So you know, really excited for some future projects. They're going to be super challenging. They're in different directions. We've very much been for the last 5 or 10 years non-invasive technology, but we're getting a lot more invasive and implantable because some really exciting tech is emerging, and that's our next challenge for the next 5 or so years.
Wow. This is kind of, I mean, I'm obviously, you guys have dug in on the research, but I'm pretty amazed at the, and I don't know if it's because of like the information the transmission is so much greater. I mean, the click of a finger. Whereas like, if you look at a lot of the literature, some of these issues with ALS, I mean, just seem to be accelerating. And like, you know, but I also wonder if that's the fact that there's more money to study, more, you know, more cases, more people, you know, because you always hear like kind of the doomsday, like, oh, all of these diseases are accelerating at much a greater rate. I'm like, yeah, our population's also grown dramatically. And we have the ability to, you know, get on Zoom calls and like translate. Whereas before, somebody might be diagnosed and it might never ever hit the system, or you might never hear about it. So I feel like the data collection is so much different, but you know, that also means like, I also have, am constantly avoiding being swayed with what I call confirmation bias, where you hear something and you just like, oh, that sounds terrible, or that sounds like the right thing.
Yeah. No, I think the jury's out. I 100% agree with you that, 30, 40 years ago, people just got sick and died. We didn't know why. They just suddenly couldn't move. And then they died, and we never really worked out why that was. So we are starting to understand more about how to better diagnose and how to research that. I also think on the other hand, there's a whole area of research emerging, exposome research, which is looking into how the environment affects our health, and how exposure to different environments, different foods, different chemicals, can be the underpinning sort of catalyst for disease emergence. The highest rates of cancer in America are in cities that are near some of the biggest chemical companies in America.
Shocker.
That's probably not a coincidence.
Well, there's a deal here in Texas. When we first moved here, we got a ton of rain, and there's creeks and like a lot of like cool swimming holes. So we got a bunch of rain. We went out to Pernales, and the kids all went swimming. I did not go swimming. My wife went swimming, and the kids and the people that she all went with, everybody got sick. Like everybody, like really, really sick the next day. And even like the few days after. So, I didn't get sick. My wife's like, typical, you didn't get sick. And I was like, I didn't go in the water. And so we ended up taking the kids to the doctor, and the doctor's like, you can't swim in the rivers or the creeks or anything after a big rain in Texas because of the glycophosphate runoff. So all these ranchers and people are trying to manage, because Texas is just a huge weed. Like if you got rid of all the people in about a year or two, Jacob, what would you think, about 2 years and Texas would take over again?
Yeah, maybe less than that.
Yeah, probably less than that. It would look like, when, what was it? The Marvel end game deal where like Thanos got rid of people and he's walking around and they're like, that's what Texas would look like in probably a weekend. And the doctor, first thing, he's like, don't swim in, because people obviously are trying to manage their stuff with glycophosphate. Everything in Texas runs downhill into creeks. It tends to pool. And, we know not to swim because we'll end up getting, and he's like, what your kids and your wife got are a little glycophosphate exposure poisoning. Gave him some like antivirals and a bunch of this, drink a bunch of water if you can, do a sauna. So we ended up getting an infrared sauna, and the kids jumped in it and we got them in, and in about 3 or 4 days they were fine. But like, that was something nobody told us. And we've never used it on our property for that very reason. But I also know that, everything runs downhill and it soaks in, but like, that shit's pretty gnarly. And, they've said for a long time, oh, it's not, it's not. And I'm like, no, that shit's like, it's pretty gnarly.
If it's killing everything else, good thing. Good yeah. chance it's going to kill you as well.
Yeah, and then it goes into the water, and then people go swimming. But yeah, that's man. Well, Doc, I am super excited that we got a chance to talk on this podcast. But if people want more information on the lab and how to get a hold of you, how do they reach out?
Yeah, they can always email me at abilitiesresearchcenter@mountsinai.org, or they can tag me on Twitter at Petrino Lab. That's probably the easiest way to get me.
Yeah. Then also PetrinoLab.com. If you guys want to go on and see his research, and they've got a website that goes through long haul COVID and some of the stuff they're doing with adventure racing. But dude, it was great to connect. I'm looking forward to this adventure with you and learning as much as we can, and hopefully helping these guys accomplish this impossible task.
Me as well. Thank you so much for having me, and looking forward to many more conversations.
Awesome. Well, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Power Athlete Radio.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market.
We've built our online training business by partnering with Train Heroic and helping us deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training.
And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best tech and training, go to trainheroic.co/powerathletehq.